Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Pat Barron, standing in today for your regular host and founder of Radio Free Market, Michael McKay. And today we are going to have a little different kind of program. It's going to be called in and talk to the economist. The economist would be me, your guest host, Pat Barron. And the call-in number is 800-313-9443. Again, that's 800-313-9443. This is an open-ended forum, and you can ask me anything you wish of an economic nature. And again, I am Pat Barron. I teach Austrian School Economics at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, Iowa. And I also have taught principles of banking at the Graduate School of Banking at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for 25 years. And the two actually go very well together. Banking is a big part of economics, of course, and understand how banking fits into a free market economy and to a sound money system is very important, and what banking's role is in the world is very important. So first let me just give you a little background of what Austrian economics is. This has been my passion for many years now. It'll be several years now since I've been teaching this and reading, and I'm really looking forward to discussing this with you, but I see that we're coming up on a break right now. So if I just hang in there, and remember, this is Pat Barron at Radio Free Market, and it's a call-in show of 800-313-9443. So hang on, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Pat Barron. I am your guest host for Radio Free Market, sitting in for regular host and founder Michael McKay. And today, this is a call-in show to me, the economist. It's call in and ask the economist a question, or just make a statement that you would like the folks to hear, and I'll comment on it. But before we get to our first caller, and I understand that there are two on the line waiting, and I ask for your indulgence while I just give the rest of the listeners a brief explanation of what is Austrian economics. And this is the school of thought that that I teach at the University of Iowa. And Austrian economics was actually a derogatory term that was coined in the latter part of the 19th century by the German historicist school. And the historicist school ruled the roost in the economic world at that time, and they said economics was pretty much just going out to the world and tabulating things. It was empirical studies, and how many square feet did people have to live in, how did they live, and how many tons of coal were produced, and this was economics. The Austrians in Austria, and being at Vienna, Austria, Karl Menger was the first sort of founded the school, made it into a systematic school of thought, and he had a different idea. It was they called the subjectivist revolution, and it says that, well, real economics is not about tabulating things, it's why people do things and why we behave the way we behave, and we behave the way we do because of our outlook on the world. And this is the subjectivist point of view, where we all look at things differently, and so there's really no way that we can say the way certain things ought to be. It's what we want them to be. So from this school of thought was developed in Vienna, Austria, several generations of great thinkers, Eugene von Bauerk and Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Weiser were some of the well-known names that came one generation after another. Most Americans have heard of Friedrich Hayek, who won the Nobel Prize in economics in 1974. He was a protege and friend of Ludwig von Mises. So that's the school of thought. It's all free market, non-interference by the government in the economy. People can do what they wish to do as long as they harm no one else. In doing so, they are free to associate with whom they wish. And very importantly, the school of thought believes that money grows out of the economy just as any other good or service, and that it must be grounded in something of real value. Thus, most Austrian economists are in favor of a commodity standard money, which today probably means gold or silver. So that's just the background. And now let's go to our first caller. So I understand it's Mr. Kruger. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Pat. I'm very pleased to be on the program today. Thank you very much for stepping in for Michael. And so my first question would be, where does really the name Austrian come from? And isn't that a very national approach to, let's say, a global indication of a economic theory?
Thank you, Mr. Kruger, for calling. I appreciate your call. And as I just stated, it grew out of the Vienna, Austria, so thus the name, and it was coined that by the Germans that, you people are just Austrians, kind of look down your nose at them. And so, as is the case in many people who are sort of disrespected by others, they take that as a badge of honor. Well, yes, we are just Austrians, and that's what you can call us. We are Austrians. But today, the school of thought has little to do with what's actually happening in the relatively small country now of Austria. Back in the 19th century, though, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a gigantic empire and one of the most liberal in all of the world, and liberal in the good sense, meaning that it was fairly free market and gave its citizens lots of freedoms and lots of liberties. I believe that you are right, and that unfortunately the name is confusing today. Perhaps to some people, when they first hear it, they say, well, this is the Austrian School of Economics, and what do these Austrians over in Central Europe have to say? But I think over time, people will start to identify it. After all, many people today seem to think that it's no problem in calling themselves a Keynesian. And what's a Keynesian? Well, I think, most people who are at least moderately versed in economics know that John Maynard Keynes has been a intellectual power since he published his first important books in the late 1920s and in the mid-1930s. And today, most economists, mainstream economists, and most governments and central banks are full of Keynesian-style economists. And I would say that these are sort of the arch rivals today of the Austrians. And the Austrians are trying to re-educate people that the Keynesian revolution that occurred back beginning of the 1930s that did supplant what at that time was the Austrian school approach, the free market approach, that this has been a gigantic mistake. And I think we're seeing the fruits of that today with our ballooning budgets, budget deficits everywhere, huge debts that people are being saddled with, the printing of money in massive amounts that is having no beneficial impact on the economy. So this is where the word comes from, Austrian economics. Historically, it's from Vienna, Austria, and it started out as a derogatory term, but now folks like me, economists like me, are very proud to call themselves Austrians. So thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much.
And I believe there's another caller on the line, is there?
Yes, hi, Pat. I'm David out in California.
Hi, Dave.
Yeah, so sounded very quiet there. I wonder if your microphone just dropped, but I can barely hear you there.
Oh, I'll try to talk a little louder. How's
there, that? There's a little better. Hey, I was interested in what I call the cost-effective life. Thomas Jefferson, in his second inaugural, talked about the economy needing to be based upon agriculture with commerce as its handmaiden. And apparently this issue about agriculture always being swamped out by the goods and services being created by commerce, in other words, products and artificial doodads and whatnot, always creating higher and higher spirals of costs, so that agricultural land gets taken up by factories, and it becomes a real strife on the society, so that food prices can't keep up with the prices of artificial goods, and so they actually become starvation and privation because of this endless problem of food prices cannot keep up with inflation, and or in some cases food prices so much keeping up with inflation that they're actually developed starvation. So I'm wondering, first of all, about this issue. Are you keeping up with what are called the Texas school book scandals?
No, I haven't heard of those.
Well, apparently, because of market forces in the textbook industry, Texas has a control of the market in textbooks in America. And there's a small body of, if I understand right, it's 11 people on a small commission in Texas, and they essentially decide what are going to be in textbooks in the future. And just last year, they decided that Thomas Jefferson is not an original thinker, that he was essentially a plagiarist, and he no longer will be in textbooks, according to the Texas schools.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and so this very concept about Thomas Jefferson's genius, about his economic theories, about his view of the future of America, are no longer going to be in textbooks because of this strange little commission in the state of Texas have essentially decided for the rest of the 50 states that he is not worthy of being in textbooks. So, that's an enormous danger. It by taking a basic philosophy about the need to have agriculture as a basis of an economy, mm-hmm. and out of the textbooks, and leaving it up to market forces to determine whether or not everything should live or die.
Okay. Well, you got two very good points there. One, the first one about Thomas Jefferson's views of agriculture being the foundation of the economy, and Jefferson's ideal that America would be primarily an agriculture economy, and then the discussion of
commerce
as a stranglehold
that
this Texas School Book Commission has on the nation's educators. Now, it brings up another point of the centralization of education in America, and especially the control of the government has of education. So I know that we are coming up fairly close to... I hear the background music now. So when we come back, Dave, I will try to discuss these two issues that you bring up. And so, ladies and gentlemen, just stay tuned, and we will be back with Radio Free Market. This is Pat Barron, your guest host, and we'll be right back. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Pat Barron, your guest host on Radio Free Market. And today is a call in to The Economist, and that's me. And the number to call is 800-313-9443. Again, that is 800-313-9443. We've had two callers so far, and the first caller asked about the origin of the name Austrian Economics, which is the school of thought that I believe is the proper school of economic thought, as opposed pretty much down the line to the Keynesian school of thought. And then the second caller asked really two questions. One was, what did I think of Thomas Jefferson's ideal of America as primarily an agricultural economy with commerce being just supportive of agriculture? And then what was my concern as his that there's a relatively small commission of 11 commissioners at the Texas School Book Commission that pretty much rules on what textbooks the rest of the country will be using, and they are sort of writing out Thomas Jefferson as being a very influential person. So I will address, first I'll address the issue of Thomas Jefferson's view of agriculture being that America should be primarily an agricultural nation. And so it was Dave from San Francisco, and Dave, I really appreciate your call. One of the main tenets of Austrian economics is that it is free market economics, meaning that we really don't tell people what they should do to make a living or how they should do it or what prices they should charge. And this even extends to the idea of, how land should be utilized. And this is an outlook that is grounded in our liberty. And Thomas Jefferson is probably our greatest advocate of the founding fathers of the liberty of the people. But it's also grounded later in the Austrian understanding of how an economy prospers and how it changes over time. And the Austrian school of thought reveals to us that people make contracts, whether implied or written, but they trade with one another, and they do so voluntarily. And when we do so voluntarily, each side expects to gain from his exchange with the other party. That doesn't mean it will always turn out to be a successful exchange. Maybe I decide that I'm going to trade my I guess it was last night when I was flying into Philadelphia, I laid over in Detroit and bought a latte. I was dying for a cup of coffee. I got a latte, and I paid, I think it was $3.50 for it, which is a lot of money, but it was sort of a treat to myself. Frankly, I was a little disappointed in it. It wasn't quite as good as I was anticipating, so the person making the latte was happy to exchange his latte for my $3.50, and I was happy at the time to exchange my $3.50 for his latte. Now, normally I would have been happy with that, but I was a little disappointed. So it doesn't mean that we're always pleased that every transaction, just because it is voluntary and we all expect that our trade will be advantageous to both of us. That doesn't always happen, but most of the time it does, because we learn from our exchanges. So there is really no reason that we should be alarmed that, say, suburbia is encroaching out onto farmland. It just means that the land itself is more valuable to the people who are building homes or shopping centers or office buildings on what was formerly farmland than the land would fetch as used as agricultural land. And as long as the person who owns the farmland, it's the farmer, is satisfied to sell his land to someone else who believes that he can make better use of it, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this. This has been probably the case in America, of course, for a long time. So America is still a very large agricultural nation. I don't really know the numbers, but I do believe that America is, if we measure the output of our agricultural production, our nation probably is the largest agricultural producing nation in the world. If not the largest in absolute numbers, probably the largest in the value of our of our per acreage output. We are a very efficient farming nation. So agriculture is very important to America. But I believe that most Austrian economists would not agree with the contention that anything should be done necessarily at a governmental level to encourage agriculture over any other type of commercial activity. So that's number one. Number two, about the fact that the Texas book commissioners have sort of a stranglehold on what the rest of the nation uses as textbooks, and they're writing out Thomas Jefferson. Very important point, and I can hear that we are coming to the end of this segment, and I will bring that up, and we'll discuss that when we come back from the break. So please stand by. This is Pat Barron on Radio Free Market. Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Pat Barron on Radio Free Market. I am your guest host, sitting in for regular host and founder Michael McKay. And this is a call-in show to The Economist. Call into The Economist. That would be me. And the number is 800-313-9443. That's 800-313-9443. And before we left for our break, I was responding to two questions from Dave in San Francisco. Dave was asking about Thomas Jefferson's idea of America as primarily an agricultural nation and what an Austrian school of thought would think of that. And my response to that was that the Austrian school, from an economic standpoint, believes that a free association among free people with free exchanges, meaning that no exchanges are not forced upon anyone, that land can be changed from one use to another, and agricultural land can be changed into for housing or for office buildings or anything else of that nature, as long as the sale of the land is mutually agreed upon by buyer and seller. And this is the way an economy changes over time for the better, because people are always looking for to improve their situation by cooperative exchange with their fellow man. He also brought up the kind of disturbing point that Thomas Jefferson himself is being written out of many textbooks that are being used in the nation. Apparently there is a very powerful book commission down in Texas, school book commission, and because they're have such a large audience in Texas, that what they decide should be taught, or the textbooks that should be used, or is it picked up by the rest of the nation's school districts? I didn't know that. We'll assume that that is correct. It may be, it may not be. I'm not saying that it is or it is not. But it does bring up a disturbing point about the control that government has over the nation's young people. And the Austrian school believes, from both a liberty idea of that we are a nation, the government should ensure our liberty, and also from just a very practical what kind of prosperity do we wish to have, that government should not be dictating to the whole nation the kind of school books we should use and what should be in them. Schooling should be primarily a responsibility of the parents. The Constitution, the United States, has nothing in it whatsoever to say, to give the federal government any control at all over education. Now, this is in Texas that the School Book Commission is, and apparently it's very influential. But it's probably influential because there has been a tremendous centralization of the curriculum by the No Child Left Behind Act. And from what I understand, no one that is actually in the education establishment is happy with the No Child Left Behind Act, which gives the federal government vast control over what is taught to the nation's students. But yet, there we are, we have it. If that is one of the primary reasons that Texas decisions on what school books to use are being picked up by the rest of the nation, and this is just another indication that this is a bad idea. We need decentralization of education. Parents should be primarily responsible for educating their children. There should be no tax dollars whatsoever going toward education. If there are any at all, our Constitution says it is reserved to the states, and the states may do what they choose. But from a liberty standpoint, education should be the responsibility of the individuals, meaning the individual parents. And education is a good in society, just as any other good, and we do not think that the government should be providing this. So let's move on. We have a couple callers waiting. I understand Larry is in Texas, and Larry, maybe you have something to add to that, or you have another question.
Yes, I have a question, maybe like a little bit of discussion. I agree with the last subject you were just talking about, but I have a real problem with the Austrian School of Economics, I guess the concept of just total free markets.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I have is it seems to me that two individual families have pretty well taken over the world and run economies globally through organizations and through proxy people who are standing in for them, like George Soros. And they come into markets like George Soros is in the process of, from what I understand, he's very shortly going to be the number three man for running the food system in the United States. It seems like all the free markets would be a good concept if everybody started out pretty well at the bottom, but we seem to be at the place, like in a Monopoly game, where we're trying to pass go and collect our $200, but there are motels everywhere you look. How in the world what does the Austrian School of Economics have to say when you've got so much power and so much money and influence in so few hands?
Okay, well, good. That's a great question, Larry. I really thank you very much for asking it. I'm not familiar with. I do know who George Soros is. Frankly, I'm not aware of what his forays are into controlling food. We'll just assume that he is going to be he's going to have a lot of influence there. The question is, you know, when someone achieves a lot of power, I believe you said, or something along that line, and Austrians would say, well, as long as the power that you have achieved has been by voluntary cooperation with your fellow man, there is nothing at all malignant about it.
Well, he wrecked the economies in Indonesia, just totally ruined their economies. Right now, we're in the process. We had corn. We had so much of a stockpile of corn, and by hook and by crook, people have gone up to our legislators, and they've lobbied them with money. And you can say that's all ethical and legal. I have problems with it.
Well, I do too.
But they've made it so that they came out with this. I think it's E87, where they were going to. They had put all this ethanol in at the gas pumps all across the country, and people mm-hmm. wouldn't use it because it caused them to get worse gas mileage, and it burned up the rubber parts on their vehicles and caused a lot of problems.
Well,
so since no one was using it, now they put it on everyone, and they're going to use up all our corn, so there's going to be shortages.
Well, Larry, what you're saying, and you're concerned about the Austrian, you're saying this is the free market, but it is not the free market. What you're describing is what we Austrians say, that is not the free market. When people buy up excess corn, and they don't really know what to do with it, so they go to the legislator, and the legislator is going to force the rest of us to use this corn because we're going to adulterate our gasoline with it, which is exactly what has been happening with this horrible ethanol industry. we are forced to use an additive, I don't know if you want to call it an additive at all, but it is debasing or diluting the energy value of gasoline in America. But this is all a forced upon us by government mandate. It is not part of the free market. In a free market, ethanol would be used, if at all, it would probably be some small niche markets. We may be using corn, or we might be importing ethanol from other countries. Understand that sugarcane-based ethanol actually is a little better, but whether it's better than gasoline, really only the end users, the free market, could tell. I understand in Germany, the Germans are standing up for their rights. The German government has been is forcing the German people to use ethanol at the pump for the lower-grade gasoline, and as a result, very little low-grade gasoline is being sold, and they're running out of the higher-grade gasoline that the German lawmakers had not touched yet. But it's this is people voting with their pocketbook. Now, getting back to George Soros or anyone else who appears to have a lot of power, I've always liked to use the example, I'd like to use someone that I think I know a little bit more about, which is Bill Gates. And Bill Gates has been wrongly challenged by many governments around the world as a monopolist. And he has a lot of power, and look what he can do. He can dictate this and dictate that. Well, but all of Bill Gates' power has been achieved through the free market by people saying that they would rather use Bill Gates' product than some other competing product. He has been a wonderfully successful businessman. In fact, right now it does appear that perhaps his empire that did appear to one time to be invulnerable is not so invulnerable, and others such as Google are starting to be more innovative than he is. But in the meantime, Bill Gates, you might look at Bill Gates' vast wealth as being an indication of his vast benefit to mankind. I take it that that is exactly what Bill Gates has been, that he has been beneficial to mankind. As long as people were buying his product voluntarily, using it satisfactorily to improve their lives, going back and buying newer versions, then if Bill Gates got very wealthy because of that, that is nothing more than an indication that of the vast amount of good that he has done to the market. I don't really know that much about George Soros. I could just say, Larry, that if George Soros achieves his power and his wealth through the free market, that is fine. If he's doing it by getting governments on his side, if he's lobbying governments, buying their votes, which is a terrible thing, then I say that this is not the free market, and this is what's wrong with really the world over, is we allow governments to have too much control of our lives, and that invites people with a lot of money to lobby these governments and get their way. So
if I could just say this.
Yeah.
John D. Rockefeller made four times as much money as Bill Gates. But the difference was, his money was made back in 1900. Do you know how much that money is worth today?
Well, he is probably worth a lot more than Bill Gates. Huh?
He's dead, but I mean, his family is still alive, and mm-hmm. they put all their money into foundations so they don't pay any taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also run our medical system, they run our education system, they run our banking system, and they run everything. And it seems like all of this talk about this Austrian economics is like arguing over who's going to sit in what chair on the Titanic.
I do disagree with you, Larry, that I think we're just going to have to agree to disagree on this. I would recommend a book that I think would takes my position, this position that John D. Rockefeller was also a force for good in this country, and that is called, name of the book is The Myth of the Robber Barons, and it talks about, it's a really very enjoyable read. It's not only John D. Rockefeller, but it was Andrew Carnegie, Charles Schwab, who founded Bethlehem Steel, and others, the Vanderbilts with the railroads, that these people were, they were good businessmen. John D. Rockefeller pretty much invented the oil industry as we know it today. Andrew Carnegie drove the price of steel down to a fraction of what it was, and at one time, Carnegie Steel produced more steel than the entire British Empire at the height of the British Empire. And these men they may have been ruthless businessmen, but what they did pretty much was completely above board, and they became fabulously wealthy through free exchange, and we're all better off for it. So I'd say that as long as a man makes his money in voluntary exchange without government standing in and forcing people to buy his product or keeping other competing products off the market, and that man gets very wealthy doing so because of voluntary exchange, then we just have to look at it. But that is the fact that he does have has achieved his power legitimately, and nobody forces us to use Bill Gates' product. Nobody forces us to buy gasoline at Standard Oil, but we do, and we do because we like the product. So I think that's about all I can tell you about that. And I wonder if we do have someone else standing by, Alex in Delaware. I think we might be coming up on a break here shortly, but we might have time for one more question. Are you there? Alex in Delaware, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Would you please ask your question or make your comment?
You want my comment now?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. I would like to know what Mr. Burns' thoughts on the Obama administration keeping us from being energy self-sufficient with its EPA rulings.
Okay.
I was wondering what he thinks of that. I would like to comment on the Myth of Robert Burns, which I found to be an outstanding book.
Thank you. I'm glad you read it.
Right.
Thanks, Alex.
Who is this? Is this Pat?
Yes, this is Pat.
This is Al Mysaki.
Well, Al, how are you?
Okay.
Well, thanks for calling
in. Let me get your thoughts on the...
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a very good friend of mine, Al Mysaki down in Delaware. I didn't realize it was this Alex in Delaware calling. One of the most well-read men that I've ever come across.
Well, thank you, Pat.
So I think we may be coming up on a break here shortly, but I'll get back to this... your question about Obama
administration. Yeah, they're using the EPA
energy self-sufficient.
To keep us energy deficient.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's outrageous, Pat. Absolutely, and nobody's saying a word about it.
Well, let me just comment on a couple. There's really a couple points here. Number one is government interference with the market of energy, and also the idea that America. Becoming energy self-sufficient. First of all, energy has been used as a political football in this country for a very, very long time.
Right.
Going back to the progressive era where the government wanted to break up the great oil trust, mainly Standard
Oil. That's true, Pat. You know, I just wrote about that.
Well, when we get back from a break, we hear the music coming on, Alex, so when the music comes on, it means we're coming up to a break.
Okay.
When we come back from that break, we'll take up this very important point. So,
okay,
ladies and gentlemen, if you just hang on here, we'll be right back to Radio Free Market. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Pat Barron with Radio Free Market. And I am your guest host, sitting in for Michael McKay. And just before the break, Alex from Delaware, an old friend of mine, had a question about Obama interfering in the energy markets and preventing America from becoming energy self-sufficient. And what would the Austrians have to say about this? So, again, this is a call-in program. We may not be able to get to another call, but if we do, the number is 800-313-9443. That's 800-313-9443. So, getting back to Alex's question about Obama interfering with our ability to become energy self-sufficient, it is probably true that America has vast untapped sources of energy that we should be allowed, we should allow our energy producers to tap. And whether or not this would make America totally energy self-sufficient, I do not know. So to make a sort of a get to the point of this, it is not important that America become energy self-sufficient. It's not important at all. What we should seek is cooperative exchange with the rest of the world. If that means that we can buy our oil cheaper somewhere else and use the scarce capital that is available in our country for something of a higher purpose, then that's what we should do. But I do believe that for decades now, mainly the environmental movement has prevented America from becoming more energy self-sufficient. In other words, from producing more of our own energy. We have vast, vast amounts of oil in the western part of the United States and in Alaska. It is unfortunate that America west of the Mississippi, that land was held by title by the United States government, by our federal government, unlike the eastern part of the United States. The federal government owns approximately 30% of the land mass of the United States, and almost all of it, with the exception of a few national parks, are west of the Mississippi and in Alaska. It has kept a lot of this land from being developed. Now, the environmentalists don't like development, but environmentalists have, in a free market, the environmentalists would be perfectly free to pool their money and to request money from the rest of us to buy as much of this undeveloped land and keep it pristine as they wish. And we would then find out, well, what is really important to the country and what is not. But I do believe that one of the ways that the United States could actually improve its finances, this is probably something for another show to talk about the terrible state of America's finances, but one of the ways we could improve our finances would be for the federal government to start auctioning off and selling its land holdings west of the Mississippi. And that means sell it to people that could do with it whatever they wish to do in accordance with state law, not with federal law, but in accordance with state law. And I believe that that means that we would produce a lot more oil than we are today. We would be satisfying a lot more of our own demand from our own resources. Do I believe that this is necessarily a good thing? Not really, because the market should choose. Economics does not know the difference where a border is drawn. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you, Alex, for calling in. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to this show today, to this call-in show with The Economist. I'm Pat Barron. I am The Economist, and this has been Radio Free Market. So whatever you do, ladies and gentlemen, stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.